As I said to you earlier on, I've had 50 years in ministry, and my primary role has been as an evangelist. Now, I've been a builder and an administrator and media person, all those other things, but primarily a proclaimer of the Word of God. So I was quite delighted, Tim, when you asked me, would I take the Bible passage for today? Now, churches that I travel around a lot, I preach constantly all over the country. I always say to the minister who invites me, what are you preaching on? Are you following the lectionary, or are you following a series on something or other? For example, last week we were at the People Builders Church at Port Macquarie, and I asked the preacher, and he said, our theme for the entire year is outrageous love. I said, that's a good theme. Do you mind if I preach on that? So I took the six chapters of Ephesians, and every chapter has something about the outrageous, extravagant grace and love of God. So when I was coming here, I asked about, are you following the lectionary? Tim said, yes, he was. The lectionary is a common set of readings that you find in all Anglican churches, most Catholic churches, most Uniting churches, some Orthodox churches. So all around the world, on any one day, basically churches of many denominations are having the same readings. And the readings are chosen to fit in, obviously, with what is happening in the church year. For example, if you're in Advent, it's about John the Baptist and the coming of Jesus. If it's Christmas, it's about the birth of Jesus. If it's after Christmas, Epiphany, it's the coming of the wise men, and so on. And you'll get to Palm Sunday, and you'll get to Good Friday and Easter. On the 24th of February this week, within all of those churches, they think about Matthias. Now, he probably isn't on your list of the top 10. And we don't think about Matthias. But from my point of view, there couldn't have been a better selection of passages than the passages for this Sunday. Let me explain to you. The Old Testament passage that you read right at the beginning is Psalm 113, and it has to do with a group of psalms that are all about the fact that our God's better than any other God, and that our God has chosen us, and He is our God, and we are His chosen people. A lot of people don't like the idea of Jewish people being the chosen people. I remember A. E. Housman, the English poet, who said, how odd of God to choose the Jews. To which someone replied, but not as odd as those who choose the God and spurn the Jews. So the Old Testament reading is about God's choice of Israel. In theological terms, we speak about it as election. In Paul's epistle, in chapter 3, Paul says, forgetting what lies behind, I choose to press on towards the mark of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. He's choosing. The gospel lesson for today is John 15. And in that, Jesus said, you did not choose me, but I chose you. And then the Acts of the Apostles, which you read to us, is all about what happened when Judas committed suicide and they were one short of 12, and so they chose or elected another one, and that was Matthias. So I want to talk to you basically about God's method of election, because it has never changed. You've got it through the Old Testament, you've got it through the New Testament, and I want to suggest we still have it today. Now let me just say by way of background, many of you will know this, there are two books written by Dr. Luke. One is the Gospel of Luke, and the other one is the Acts of the Apostles. And they were both written to one person, whom Luke calls Theophilus, with two Greek words meaning the lover of God. You lover of God. He doesn't give us his real name. There were reasons for that, and the reasons were that those who could be tracked down by Roman persecutors at this time could be put to death. We think modern scholarship knows exactly who it was. He was a nobleman, like a senator, with legal background. He belonged to a group of people called the equestrians, who that was a rank in high society. He and his wife, we know they were both Christians. They were related to the emperor, but when Domitian became emperor and had a bad persecution, these two were martyred and died for their faith. Some scholars think that Luke wrote this to Flavius Clemens because he was the judge at the trial of the Apostle Paul. And he wanted to explain to the judge how it was that this Jewish religion called Christianity began and who it was that Jesus of Nazareth was and went right up to the time of his resurrection and then ascension into heaven, as Tim mentioned before. And then volume 2 begins, Most Noble Theophilus, I've already written to you all that Jesus began to do and to teach until the time came when he was taken up to heaven. Now I want to tell you what happened since and how Peter and John and the other disciples had their ministry, and in particular Paul, whom he didn't mention at this stage. Someone asked me, why was it that he wrote two volumes? Why didn't he just write one thick book? Well, the answer's simple. A scroll upon which they wrote was approximately 26 feet long. And at the end of the first scroll, you came to the end, so you started the second scroll. Dr. Luke was a medical doctor. How do we know that? Well, when you study his writings, you notice a number of insights. For example, in the Gospel, when he's talking about the healings of Jesus, he's very specific about what kind of illness it was and what kind of healing was required. For example, many of you know one of the healings of Jesus in Luke's Gospel, the others avoid it, is about the woman who for 12 years had a continuous flow of blood. Luke says, she needed, and he uses two Greek words, she needed a hysterectomy. That was not known or used by people like Matthew, who was an accountant. You wouldn't expect an accountant to be able to use medical terms. Or do you remember in the book of Acts when Peter and James were coming down the steps of the gate beautiful and then going up into the temple to pray, there was a man there that was lame from birth and he asked for money. And Peter said, look, silver and gold have I numbered, what I give you in the name of the Lord Jesus. Get up and walk. And it says the man stood up, having never been able to walk since birth. And he began to shout and leap and jump and run. Why all that business? Because Luke uses a word which means the inner ankle bone. It had gone. But from the time they healed him, it says his ankles were strong. And that's why it says he was leaping and jumping and praising God and so on. Luke was a medical doctor. He lived in what we would today, the biggest city to it is Beirut in Lebanon. He joined Paul and Silas and Timothy and Aristarchus and Trophimus and Epaphroditus and a whole bunch of other young ministers that traveled with Paul. What happened with Paul is that he would go into a major city and start preaching the gospel. And he sent his young preachers up the valleys, up the rivers, and they established basically country church. As a matter of fact, I wrote a thesis all about this. about Paul's urban strategy, because he only went to those places like Ephesus and Athens and so on, which were what we call in Latin the urbs. Now you get in the English word urban transit and so on, you see. Now the urbs usually had a Jewish synagogue, they had Roman administration, they had Greek culture, language and teachers. They were the major commercial centres. And Paul ministered in the urbs, and he sent his younger ministers up the river and up the valley and out into the backlogs there, and that area was called in Latin the suburbs. I think I know when Luke started to follow the Apostle Paul. He was in a place called Troas, which is on the west coast of Turkey. We know it better as Troy. You remember Helen of Troy, Menelaus, and Face That Launched a Thousand Ships, and very good colour movies in the 1950s and 60s. He was in Troy, and he was disturbed by a dream of a man of Macedonia saying, "Come over and help us." How do I know that was Luke involved there with Paul, because Paul went? Because Luke wrote down everything that Paul did. From the time, this moment in Scripture, from now on, he writes only about Paul. But he changes tense. You see, when he writes the early part of the Acts of the Apostles, about Peter and John and so on, he says, they went here and they did this. And they went up to Antioch. And Peter went over to the coast. And they went. But from that moment on, the grammar changes, and he says, and therefore we went to Macedonia. And we went to Thessalonica. And we went to Philippi. And we went to Athens. And we went to Corinth. So I know he was traveling as an eyewitness at that time. Okay, now's the test. I've said he knows medical terms. I've said he's a well-educated man. In fact, the opening of the Gospel of Luke and the opening of the Acts, together with the opening of John's Gospel, my old professor in classical Greek, not the New Testament Koine Greek, but the classical Greek, told us in a lecture on one occasion, this is the finest example of classical educated Greek writing that you can find in the ancient world. So he was an educated man, he was a doctor, he travelled with the Apostle Paul. One other thing. I told you that Flavius Clemens was probably the judge, and he was trying to explain things to him about Paul. One of the ways we know this is because he mentions a lot of Jewish words, place names and people, but he always interprets them and gives it in Latin, which the judge would understand. And you've got it here in verse 12. For example, he says, he writes, "Now the disciples came from the Mount of Olives to Jerusalem about a Sabbath day's walk, which is 1 kilometer. Now, if he was writing to a Jewish person, he wouldn't have to explain that the Mount of Olives to Jerusalem is about a kilometre or a Sabbath day. But he does that every time. If you look down the next verses about Judas, for example, when he kills himself, Judas ties his belt around his neck and is absolutely distraught on the edge of a cliff. And it was a cliff out of which they got clay for pottery. And he does explain in the scriptures here that it was called the Potter's Field. But ever since the death of Judas, it's been called the Field of Blood. He's explaining it as he goes. Judas tied the belt around his neck, threw himself over, and hanged himself. However, either it came undone or broke or something, because it says his body hit the rocks below. And I love the King James Version, because it says, and all his bowels gushed out. Which is much more graphic than his intestines went all over the place. But that was the death. Now Peter said, when 120 of them gathered in the upper room, David said, he's gone to his reward. And David in the Old Testament says, let another take his place. And so he said, we will choose, elect another to take his place. Now, here I think are four principles that is God's method for election. And the first one is this. Before you elect a person, you have to pray about what you're going to do. And so they gathered together and they were praying. And it mentions the name of quite a number of well-known people from the Gospels who are in the upper room praying. By the way, it mentions that the Virgin Mary was praying with them. That's the last mention of the Virgin Mary in first century writing. And she was left at prayer in the book of Acts. So they prayed about it. And before you ever go to an election, I believe you ought to pray for God to guide you in whom you choose. So the election must be in an atmosphere of prayer. Second part of God's method of election was to look at the candidates. Now, there happen to be two candidates here, and it probably has got them up on the screen, or else it will in the next verses. There was Joseph, who was called Barsabbas, also known as Justice, and look, he was the front runner. He was the best known of the two. But there was also Matthias. Now, Matthias doesn't really rank very high in anybody's list of great apostles. Actually, we don't know anything about him before this verse in the entire New Testament. And secondly, he's never mentioned again. In fact, the early Christian fathers who wrote the history of all of the disciples and so on don't even know how he died, except it was as a martyr, as a witness, martyrs, a witness for Jesus Christ. Now, they had to and they don't know where he died. There are three main historians writing about 50 or 60 years after this choice, and they had three different answers as to where he died. So, I mean, he's not big on the scale of saints. But what is interesting is how he was chosen. They shared together in prayer that God would guide them to the best person. Then secondly, they examined them. In fact, Peter laid down a couple of criteria. They had to be with us from the very first day of Jesus at his baptism with John. So he looked back over 3 years and he says, these two must each have been with us from that time. And they had to be eyewitnesses of the resurrection. There's no point in witnessing to the resurrection as an apostle if you cannot speak out of your own knowledge. So they had to be with us. That was one of their qualities. And they had to have been eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus. Now, I suggest whenever you get candidates coming to you for election, and they all come round church wanting you to support. I got a letter on Thursday. I've just been up along the coast, and somewhere up in the Northern Rivers area, a minister wrote down and said, we've got a National Party member, and he's come to our church and asked me, could he speak next Sunday to the congregation and ask them to vote for him? But I better check up, is he a Christian or not? And he said, and I wrote back to him and said, I cannot tell you whether he's a Christian or not, but this I know. I visited him 9 years ago and asked him to join the Parliamentary Christian Fellowship, and he's never been to one meeting. I happen to run every Thursday the Parliamentary Prayer Meeting, where members of the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, the National Party, the Christian Democrat and myself attend every Thursday, and he's never attended. I run weekly and monthly Bible studies for parliamentarians, and a lot come. But he has never attended. And then once a year we gather together all the Christian parliamentarians and add about 300 church leaders in Sydney, and we spend a day of a lunchtime of thinking and fellowship and eating together, and he's never been to one of our Christian fellowship lunches. So, he might be a Christian. In fact, it's my opinion that come election time, every politician's a Christian. But I can tell you he's never associated with any Christian activity in the last 9 years in parliament. So I don't think you'll get a green card to go to church next week. What is it you should ask candidates? First of all, to take just those things that are mentioned in Scripture. You remember Micah said, what does the Lord require of you? But to love mercy and do justice and walk humbly with your God. And I think you should ask every candidate questions about, do they do deeds of mercy? Are they interested in promoting the welfare of the unemployed, the poor, the widow, the child in need, the ill-educated, people who are disabled, the war widow? Do they act justly? And that is, do they vote in such a way that justice for all is given? If you happen to be in one party and getting a fair bit of money at the moment from the petroleum industry, of course you're going to vote for coal seam gas exploration. But is that just? The greatest, finest, most productive agricultural land in the whole of Australia being used for fuel when it should be used for food? So ask questions about justice. Is it just that giant supermarkets sell milk for a dollar? What's that doing to the whole dairy industry? Is that just? Start asking questions about, do they do justly? I've got a member of the Family First Party who just loves to look up Hansard, and he's taken every Christian in Parliament, just gave it to me last Saturday, and then showed all the very important Christian issues and then ran lists of how they voted. Yes, yes, no, no, yes, no, weren't there, didn't vote, etc. I was disappointed. How many Christians did not vote in Parliament for Christian things? Now, the reason for this is quite simple. You have to vote as your party decides. And that decision is not made by the parliamentarians. It's made by head office. The Labor Party head office, the coalition head office, they make the decision. And if the parliamentarians disagrees or goes out, they are expelled from the party. The Labor Party expels you that day. And from then on, no other member of the party will talk to you or eat with you. You're not allowed to go into any meetings room with anybody else. The expulsion is immediate. The Liberal Party and National Party are a little bit more refined. They wait until the next election and drop you off the ticket. And four Liberal and National Party good parliamentarians disagreed with head office and they are not coming up for this election because they got the job. Actually, there are only two people in Parliament that can vote with their conscience, and that's Reverend Fred Nile and myself. The Constitution of Family First says not that I may vote conscientiously, but I must vote according to it. So the questions you ask, are they doing justice and good? But the Bible has a lot more questions about how the poor are treated, about how the refugee is treated, about how the asylum seeker is treated. Now let me just tell you, in the Jewish Old Testament, there are lots of questions about the treatment of asylum seekers and people coming as foreigners and strangers from other lands. So you should ask about their policies on such matters. You should ask for policies about how they treat widows, war widows, how they treat the poor, the disabled, the people who cannot read, the ignorant, people who cannot write because of some disability. Ask them those sort of questions. because they're all in the Bible, every one of them. So here's the third principle. First of all, pray about how you should go. Secondly, examine the candidate. Thirdly, let them, whatever they do, get on with the business. Once you've chosen them, don't make it difficult for them. Now, the interesting thing is the choice went to Matthias. And honestly, if someone had been running a book in those days, he wouldn't have been the favourite. But he was the favourite. He was not the favourite, but he got elected. I don't know why. But I do know that Joseph Barsabas, immediately after Matthias's election, stayed with the believers and ministered with them for the rest of his life. I've met a whole lot of people who were elected as candidates who get defeated, who no longer have anything to do. They get the dummy and spit it out. Let the ones elected do the job. You can criticize them. You can write complaints to them. You can disagree with them. But they've been chosen, so let them do the job. You will have another election coming up when you can change your vote. And then the fourth thing that you do, Dr. Luke uses an interesting expression. It says, and they cast their lots individually, is part of the grammar. Individually. Now, actually, I was casting my lot on an issue on Friday. It was the most stupid thing you've ever heard. But it was being run by the ABC, television and radio, and they hate being criticised. And what they're doing, they're having the heads of all the political parties for the New South Wales election in, and we had to select what days, what times, what areas on radio, etc., we would be giving our political broadcast, because they must give so much time. But we are the people who have to choose which time. So there's no argument. The ABC had printed out lots. I had lot A for something. So when the time for choice came, if B got chosen, they went first. Lot A went second. Then they had numbers, 1 to 8. And then we had to reach into a hat like this. No one can peep. Pull out one number. And I was number 6. So that meant I had certain type. Now look, I trust the ABC. But a lot of people don't. And therefore, they wanted to be not only seen to be, but they had to be clear and above board. And the way of doing this was people cast lots. In the Old Testament times, and in the time of Jesus, there were little, usually tiles, that had numbers or letters on them, and these were lots. And they'd hand out 6 of them, and when the time came, you threw them. It could have big consequences. You remember the Old Testament book of Jonah. He's on a boat. The boat's sinking. It's in the middle of a terrible storm. The sailors are a bit superstitious, and they say, we're going to drown because there is someone on board this with whom the gods are ill-pleased. We've got to get rid of that troublemaker. Someone said, I know who it was. It's so-and-so. Someone said, I know who it was. It was so-and-so. And someone said, no, I actually think it's this Jewish bloke, Jonah. He's the one. And so it says the sailors cast their lots. Jonah copped the number, and he was then cast overboard. That's not the end of Jonah, but they thought they'd get rid of him because they cast lots. The book of Proverbs says an interesting thing. It says, when you cast your lot, God is guiding your choice. And so they cast individually their lot. There's no record of some of the believers who came down from Galilee saying, well, as a matter of fact, I don't like either of these people. They're both no good for us. And not only that, they all come from the south, from Judea. And I'll tell you what, I can't trust the person who comes from. They didn't say that. They cast their ballot. Now, I know some Christians that say, Well, I can't be bothered with any of them. I will just go in and write something across the ballot paper. You're allowed to do that. It's quite legal. There is no law that says you must write on a ballot paper. In fact, there is no law that says you must vote. The law says you must go to a polling place and have your name crossed off. However, if you don't vote, you are wasting an opportunity to have a say in our country. If you don't vote, why don't you go and live in Libya? Or Bahrain? Or Saudi Arabia? Or Iran? Or Iraq? They don't get a chance to vote democratically. Do you realise there are men and women in this country, and particularly in Great Britain and Europe, who died in order for ordinary people like us to have the right to vote? And if you don't vote, you're actually denying what they have done. You understand the point I'm trying to make? And Luke says, and they individually cast their ballot. And Matthias was there. Well, he didn't set the world on fire, but he was one of the apostles, and he became a faithful witness throughout the rest of his life. And that is why in the Anglican Church, in the Uniting Church, in Catholic churches and so on, we've just passed February the 24th, which is St. Matthias's Day. And that's why on the Sunday nearest to us, we had the readings that Tim read and brought to us. It's a very important lesson because I think in those four principles, it shows us God's method of election. Now, I am an evangelist and a preacher, therefore I preach and I want to evangelize. But I'm also here to talk not only about God's method of election, but I want to say something to you about this coming election. I'll take 4 minutes. Out in the supper room, I know that because this is Narrabri and because it's time we all had something to drink and eat. So I know we're going to have supper. Out in the supper room, there are, I'm not even going to talk about it, but there is one blue folder that talks about what we as Family First and myself have been doing the last year. Would you care to hang on to that for me? There is a number of these which are bumper stickers. And I encourage you to take one or two and put it on your bumper. Put it on your tractor. Would you look after that for me? There is here a letter that I have basically written, which is about the policies of Family First. Now, there are 70 pages of them on the internet, so I wrote a 500-word summary. And that gives you the title. There is a red folder here. It is still time because the elections are not officially called yet. And so politicians are going around asking for people who stand for their party. Now, if you are interested in standing for Family First, there is this red folder. Put your name in, address on it, I'll get back to you. If you want to get my weekly electronic magazine, put your name and email address, I'll send it to you as well. And there's no charge for any of those. I don't believe in taking an offering because every country church I know is struggling to make ends meet. I bought just a couple of my latest books. I've given them to Family First. They're $29.95, but if you buy them, I've got a couple of $20 each, and the $20 shall stay in Narrabri and will help pay for the printing. We're printing 4.6 million voting ballots, where if we get a candidate from this gathering, your name will be on 4.6 million times. We'll also point about 1.6 million how to vote cards with your name on it. And all you've got to do when you're voting for the upper house, because in New South Wales we have what is called optional preferential voting. You don't have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. When I last stood for election, there were 292 candidates for 21 positions. If you make one mistake, your whole vote is invalid. Don't try to do that. The Liberals, National Party, the Labor Party, Family First will tell you just put one against their name. If you want to vote Family First, Gordon Moyes, put one. That's all you need to do. You don't have to worry about any other numbers. It is optional. If you want to, you can go one Gordon Moyes, two somebody else, three somebody else, but please don't try to go up to 200 because there were 74% of all people that tried to do that in the last election whose vote became invalid. That's why it's been changed. Now, there's one final thing. Up here at the Uniting Church, I've got very happy memories. When we had the great flood about Wee War and Narrabri and some of these others in about, what was it, year 2000, and I had people set apart so that the day a bad flood or an earthquake or a bushfire or something happened, we swung into action. Everybody knew what to do. And the day or so afterwards, I pulled up with a semi-trailer load in Narrabri of white goods, washing machines, refrigerators and so on, to replace those families that had lost their refrigerators and freezers and washing machines and so on. But we brought up also a semi-trailer load packed with hundreds of cartons. And in that carton, we not only had food and cans and you know, long-life milk and all that sort of stuff, but we had toilet rolls and toothbrushes. And so if you had been wiped out, as I remember doing the same at Nundle, and at Nundle, when that got flooded out, everything was taken, unbelievable. So we had, and I rang up Revlon and all these ladies' makeup and perfume, so I had packs of really nice stuff, because when you're in the flood, the last thing you think to do is grab your lipstick. And so we had all this stuff out there, and about 420 people from Narrabri came up to the Uniting Church and took these big parcels. Now, on every one, I think we had $50 taped down, because I believe you shouldn't bring into a town what the town can produce. So with $50 or something, it was meat and bread and milk, because that helps the local economy. And we gave out 420, as I remember. I also went out to some farms. This is the big stuff, because I raised money the previous year in Sydney to help the people suffering from the bushfire and the floods. And corporations said to me, "What bushfire?" I said, "Mate, this is Australia. We haven't had them yet. But this is the land of flooding plains. And when they come, it's too late to raise the money." So I had every Commonwealth Bank branch open for donations, and I used the television and radio. So when we came up here, I got hold of the district financial councillors and said, "Who has lost the most?" And they were mainly farmers who had crops wiped out, and you know, just terrible. So I had the joy of going around Narrabri and Wee War and so on, just speaking to families who had lost everything, including next year's seed and all that sort of stuff. I was wearing a hat. I'd just sit down, take my hat off, get talking for a while, and then I'd peel out of the inside of the hat a check and give it to the family. Every check was for $10,000 to help them get on their feet again. I tell you, I had more kisses in Narrabri than anywhere in my life. And at Wee War, well, I won't tell you what they were offering in Wee War, but amazing. So we come back here today with a real sense of happy memories. God bless you in your church and in your ministry in this area.